There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred with you in Little Stevens Underground Garage, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. My guest today is Chuck Prophet, singer, songwriter, guitarist, and producer. He's written or co-written songs that a number of our favorite underground garage artists have done, from Alejandro Escovedo to Ryan Hamilton to Solomon Burke. Since his early days as a member of Green on Red, he's also pursued an active solo career. And this season, we've been spinning his tune, Summertime Thing, quite a bit. It's off the 2002 album, No Other Love. We hear some of that now, followed by my chat with Chuck on your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Well, the sun's burning down on the pavement. Money in the bank, I ain't gonna save it. Jenna coming by, hope she makes it. Jenna coming by, I sure hope she makes it. It's a summertime thing. Summertime thing. There's a party next door that sounds like it's cooking. I poked my head over the wall, took a look in. Was a five-piece band, they was really rocking. Some kind of family reunion. Hey, it's a summertime thing. Summertime thing. Summertime thing. Summertime thing. Well, that summer heat's got me feeling lazy. Air is warm and the sky is hazy. People getting down, getting crazy. Oh, people getting down, it's people getting crazy. Hey, it's a summertime thing. Summertime thing.
Mighty Manfred with you once more for your coolest conversations. And I am joined today by singer, songwriter, guitarist, and producer Chuck Prophet. Chuck, how are you?
I'm all right, Manfred. Great to be here with you here in the Underground Garage.
Well, I'm very happy to be chatting with you and have you with me. Now, I want to ask you, man, how is that summertime thing working for you this August?
It's been working great for me. The song's perennial. I didn't really see that coming when I wrote it. It's like a holiday song, you know? It comes up every year. So, I mean, the record goes back to 2002. It was a record that came out on New West Records, and it kind of got my skinny foot in the door at radio. And the summer of 2002, we did a big national tour with Lucinda Williams, playing a lot of outdoor theaters and things. And it was a great, great year. That record's been really good to me.
So it's off the album No Other Love. Last few weeks or this summer certainly resonated with us in the Underground Garage. I know you grew up in Nixon land, as you might call it, born in Whittier, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. So does any specific adolescent summer play into this tune?
Yeah, I mean, I was a surfer kid. You know, I think in the first verse, there's a band playing, and yeah. I saw a bunch of bands playing backyards. I grew up in Orange County, so right there on the edge. Whittier is right there in L.A. County, but right on the edge of what we call the Orange Curtain. I grew up in a town called La Habra, and I don't know how to describe it other than it was the kind of place where if you shook an orange tree, five guitar players would fall out. You know? So, I mean, I lived just off Harbor Boulevard. You could take Harbor Boulevard, you know, straight down to Newport Beach. I mean, I was a little surfer brat, a little skateboard brat, and played guitar, and it was a wonderful time, you know.
That particular tune, did it percolate for a while, or did it just pop right out of the oven?
It was one of those things where I was running a tape recorder, and I improvised a lot of the verses, you know. And then I kind of started to... I don't know. I started ironing out the wrinkles, you know, and I thought it was kind of unfinished because when it came to first of all, it's just three chords for the whole song, even the verse and the chorus. And so when I got to the chorus, I just shouted "Summertime Thing," but that was what I wrote at the top of the page, you know, and I figured I would return to it and write a proper chorus, you know. That was like a holding place. It was kind of like, when you make a big soup, you throw people throw the bone in there. And when it comes time to serve it up, you take the bone out. Well, in this case, I just left the bone in there.
Well, that's good that you did. That way people can gnaw on it, you know?
Sure. And I remember playing it with the band, you know, and I was going to say to them, oh, I'm going to work on this other section, you know. And I remember the mood of the room changing, and I do remember people getting kind of happy, you know. It was just something to do with the groove and the way it felt with those changes, and so I was definitely, you know, I'm definitely sensitive when I'm playing something for the first time to the band, you know. I mean, my antenna's up, and I'm, you know, very sensitive. So yeah, I remember it pretty well.
Well, you mentioned being a kind of a surf brat there in Orange County. What was there much music in your household, in your home growing up?
Well, my older sister, no, I mean, it wasn't like we were a musical family with a piano or anything like that. But my older sister did bring home an acoustic guitar from, you know, I think probably like CYO camp, you know, Catholic youth something.
Oh, okay.
And I immediately figured out that Heart of Gold lick, you know, ching, 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 do, 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 do. And and that was kind of how I started playing. Like I said, everybody where I grew up was playing guitar, and everybody was playing guitar, you know, around at school and stuff. And so it wasn't really until punk rock came along that, you could even fantasize about doing something as audacious as being in a band and writing your own songs and stuff, you know. And so that was a pretty big moment for me. As when punk rock came along, it was my friend Alejandro Escovedo describes it, it erased the line between the stage and the audience, you know.
Yeah. And so about how old were you at the time? Was this when you were in high school?
Yeah, I was 15, you know. Yeah. When I was about 14, 15. When I was 16, my family moved up to the Bay Area.
Okay.
And it was there that I started tuning into stuff like Calex and the Maximum Rock and Roll shows. I think it was Tuesday nights. It was a lot like the Underground Garage, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't really find my tribe right away, but I used to tune into that show. And it was great radio. It was the early days of punk rock, so they'd play some imported punk rock records. They may play some local bands, you know. And then they might run out of records, and they just play some Kinks rarities or rockabilly records. And, I heard the first version of I remember hearing the early version of Brand New Cadillac, you know, that opened that Clash record, and thinking, oh, that's interesting, you know. And and plus the host, they would interject like progressive politics into the whole thing. I mean, it was really great. I used to record it on my little cassette recorder.
Did you have an external mic and hold it up to a clock radio?
No, it wasn't that primitive. I did have a pretty good boombox that you could record the radio. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I had to work a clock radio.
Right.
That, that was the radio.
Yeah, and, for sure. I mean, especially growing up in Los Angeles, you know, with KZY and, you know, KMET and KLOS and later KROQ and just great radio, you know.
So did you play any bands?
I played in countless bands. And, you know, I guess when I started going to college, I joined up with a group called Green on Red here in San Francisco. And, you know, we got in the van and I have to admit, when I joined them, they were pretty bourgeois. I mean, they had a van and they had a gas card, which to me was,
whoa,
you know, they'd really card. Made it, you know? And yeah. So
Green on Red, so Gas, Food, and Lodging, that era. I was in college and I was working at this local radio station, WOG 90.5 FM in Athens, Georgia. And I can't recall if the first time I saw you guys was when that No Free Lunch EP came out or whether it was Gas, Food, or Lodging. But I saw a couple of times there in Athens. Do you remember playing there at all?
I remember playing the 40 Watt. I also remember the 6. I also remember the 688 Club
in Atlanta.
Yes, and I remember standing on stage, and I said to the sound guy, "I said, what's that?" And you know, there's a bunch of Iggy Pop songs written in Sharpie on the wall. He goes, "Oh, that was Iggy's set list. They just thought it would be cool to write it on the wall instead." I said, "Oh, that's cool." And then I also remember the night that we played the 688. Because Alex Chilton opened those shows, and I remember Alex pulling up in that Buick LeSabre. He had a little three-piece band with Renee Coleman and Doug Garrison, and who I later got to know. And he pulled that super reverb out of the trunk and set it up, and you know, he tuned his guitar to a harmonica, and. You know, and they did a little sound check, and he played those opening chords of September Girls, you know, and I remember thinking,
oh, wow.
And you know, Manfred, that was the first time I'd ever heard that song. Just those slashing chords, you know, and I thought, what the hell is going on here? And that was Alex Chilton, you know, and I don't know who my heroes were at the time, but they all kind of went up in smoke, and Alex was kind of my guy, you know, still is.
And then you wound up with 3 copies.
Along the way, yeah, with all that touring and all the record stores that we visited. I do believe this one copy came from Fayetteville, Arkansas. I think I remember paying $15 and thinking, oh, I don't know. Gee,
so
I don't
how did
know.
You
that's,
wind
that's
up
my per diems for like a week.
All right. How did you wind up in Green on Red?
Well, I was a fan, you know, I went to see them. I was in a band called Wild Game, and we opened for them, and Danny, the singer, said, "Hey, if I break a string, can I borrow your guitar?" I said, "Sure, man." And then he said, "Better yet," he said, "Why don't you just come up and play with us for the encore?" And then, you know, one thing led to another, and I was down in Los Angeles, and I called him and said, "Hey, I want to come down and see you." They said, "Well, bring a guitar, why don't you?" And you know, after that show, they said, "You know, do you have a passport?" I said, "Oh no, I can get one." They said, "Yeah, well, we're going to Sweden in like 2 weeks," and so that was really the beginning of a lot of European touring for us in those early days. You know, we blew through Sweden, and you know, I remember the second time we went to Sweden, they said, "At the end of this tour, would you guys like to play a show in London?" And we said, "Well, sure," you know, and they said, "Okay, well, here's what you're gonna do. You'll get into the airport, take the tube into, you know, King's Cross station, and go to this address, and pick up a carton of Rothman Blue cigarettes from the duty free. Very important." Okay, and so of course we blew that off. You know, we had our gear on the tube, and we went into some kind of bed sit in King's Cross. And this guy came the next day and gave us our directives. You know, and he said, do you have the cigarettes? And we said, oh no, we didn't. No, we didn't. He goes, very disappointed, gentlemen. And we got past that and ended up playing a gig. We ended up playing a gig in a place called Alice in Wonderland, I think, in Piccadilly Circus there down in a basement. It was like a goth club. And the other band loaded in. Backline was provided, and the other band loaded in. And that was the Jesus and Mary Chain. So they played.
Wow.
They played first. There was probably about 12 people there. After three songs, the bartender just calmly walked up on stage and turned their amps off and said, okay, fellas, just let's go. And then we played, and, you know, I remember a lot of cameras going, like flash pops, you know, flash bulbs popping off. And, you know, I think a week later, Danny the singer, he stayed behind and went up and down New Bond Street, and we ended up signing with Polygram. And I guess you would have seen us a few months later after we did that No Free Lunch EP for Polygram. We did a couple records for Phonogram in the UK.
You're in Green on Red for a while, and then the band eventually ends, but you had already started doing some solo stuff before it ended, or not?
Yeah, well, I mean, we would kind of disintegrate after every tour, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I started playing acoustically in the back room of this bar on 16th Street here called the Albion, and with Stephanie Finch, who, you know, I later married, of course, and Steve Yerke and Patrick Winningham and some songwriters. And so, you know, we were really into the basement tapes and you know, quieter music. At the time, everything was pretty big and loud, and the bass players, you'd have to carry an SVT up a flight of stairs, you know, and everything, you know, I'd say the Replacements kind of loomed large over everybody at that time. Yeah. And so we were doing this other thing, and that was really, I guess, where my solo career started, because I recorded a record, you know, a pretty low budget record called Brother Aldo, and then, you know, made another one after that, and just, yeah, that was it. And eventually, Green on Red kind of, you know, we sort of went out of business. I don't know if we ever had a big breakup moment.
We mentioned working with Alejandro Escovedo. I know you guys have several albums, like Real Animal, Street Songs of Love, Big Station. Will you co-write the tunes with him? How did you guys meet, and what got the ball rolling with your collaboration?
I'm not sure when we met, but I did see Rank and File. You know, I saw Rank and File here in San Francisco opening for DOA. And it didn't look good, you know, when they came out. playing the Wabash Cannonball or whatever. And
now that's some punk rock right there.
Absolutely. But, you know, I mean, the Kinman brothers had cred. They had been in the Dills. You know, I knew that much. And by the end of the set, they had all the punks, you know, practically square dancing. And so I remember Alejandro from that. And I also saw the True Believers. He's just, Al's one of those guys, like, we don't really know when we met, but I've always felt like I've known him my whole life. You know, he grew up in Huntington Beach. And yeah, there's just a lot of overlap, and you know, Al's good company. So, you know, hanging out and writing songs is always a blast. And we always got something whenever we got together.
You guys still may work again in the future, right?
Sure.
Yeah. We've also supplied songs and collaborated with a lot of other folks, with Kay, Kim Ritchie, Kylie Willis. I also read somewhere that you were a staff songwriter in Nashville.
Well, in 1997, I put out a record called Homemade Blood. I signed a publishing deal with BMG. And there were some expectations, you know. And my publisher at the time came up with the idea of sending me out to Nashville and you know, hooking me up with some writers on Music Row, which was pretty audacious, really. I mean, I wanted to say, like, yeah, maybe after that you can send me to Hollywood and I'll write a screenplay. You know, I mean, I felt like, you know.
Why not?
But in the end, you know, all the stuff that I'd learned, really, you know, in terms of putting songs together and just the basic, you know, toolbox actually helped me pretty good. So I did, yeah, I did some writing out in Nashville for a while. And I made some friends like Angelo Petraglia and Kim Ritchie and people that I still write with to this day.
What about this? There's a tune you did with Dan Penn that I'll say His Majesty, the King of Rock and Soul, Solomon Burke did, called I Need a Holiday.
Oh, man, Manfred, you're going deep. I'm flattered.
Oh, yeah. We're this is the end of the pool that we swim in, brother man.
Okay. Okay. Dan Penn and I used to get together. Dan Penn wrote some stuff with Green on Red when we made a record in Nashville.
The Dan Penn thing that predates this whole publishing deal.
Well, yeah, we were kind of friends. Well, Spooner Oldham was a favorite of ours, you know, in terms of Green on Red hiring a keyboard player for our records, and he introduced us to Dan, and you know, we went over there late one night and wrote a song with Dan, and then he took us into his garage at like 3 a.m. and started up a motorcycle. It was loud, you know. he had a little 4-track back then, and we recorded. And then a couple of years later, I returned to Nashville to write for BMG, and I used to go over to Dan's, and we would write. And one time he said that Solomon Burke was looking for songs, and so we wrote that song, I Need a Holiday, and they cut it. I believe it ended up like on a European EP. It didn't end up on that song, that excellent Solomon Burke record that Joe Henry produced. You know, kind of a thrill there, Manfred, to hear Solomon Burke singing your words, you know?
Did you ever get to meet the man or watch him perform?
Yeah, I did a couple times. We performed with him. We opened for him in Golden Gate Park. And then we also played a show in Central Park, Chuck Prophet and the Mission Express, of course. Oh. With Lucinda Williams and Solomon Burke, and my mom, who, you know, hasn't always taken a great interest in what I'm doing. She and my sister did fly out to that show in Central Park, and I think my mom was pretty impressed.
Very cool. So Summertime Thing, we were talking about that, and the album's No Other Love, that title track, Heart wound up covering like a couple of years later.
Yeah.
Did they just cover the song and then you found out about it? Or was your song specifically pitched to them?
The way I understand it is later I learned that they were shy, like one, you know, ballad for Anne, you know. Of course, we love the Wilson sisters, you know.
Yeah.
And Heart. And I think it was Cameron Crowe that pitched it to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Nancy told me. And I didn't know anything about it. No, I was working on another record, and I was kind of focused on that. And I got a call from my manager. He said, I don't know if this is going to work, but you got an offer to open some dates for Heart. And I thought, this was probably back in 2004. I thought, gee, like what would that be? You know? He said, yeah, I guess they recorded one of your songs. And I said, wait, rewind. So, you know, that's where we learned it. Yeah. And the record came out, and you know, I was pretty proud of that. I mean, I met, and, you know, I did end up doing some gigs opening for them, and their tour manager said, you know, Ann would like to meet you, and they brought me back, you know, down this hallway. I think it was the Celebrity Theater in Phoenix, one of those theaters like where Sinatra used to play, that right. Where the stage rotates. There was one here called the Circle Star. They're part of a chain, I think.
Uh-huh.
And it was, and they brought me into her dressing room. It was really dark in there, and I just felt like I was meeting Elvis. You know, and is you know, stunningly beautiful. Just in person.
Has anybody ever done one of your songs and afterwards you thought, wow, they totally didn't get it. They messed that up.
Yeah, most of the time. No. No, not at all. I mean, they're all great, you know. And I should also mention that I've become pals with Ryan Hamilton, and he recorded a song of mine called Big Man that was the coolest song in the world. And that was also a great thrill. And Ryan hit it out of the park, as far as I'm concerned.
And how did that all come together?
Well, during the pandemic, we would talk occasionally, and we were trying to write long distance, and we weren't having much luck, you know. And then,
wait a minute. I'm sorry for interrupting, but how did you guys even come in contact with one another?
I don't know. I just feel like we knew each other in some way or another, and I was a fan. And, you know, we might have slipped up into the DMs, as the kids say.
Yeah.
and we talked about, you know, maybe writing, and like we tried something long distance, and it just didn't really, you know, it helps to be in a room together, you know.
Yeah.
And so later he reached out and asked if I had any songs laying around, because he had this concept of doing a record of, you know, written by people that, you know, he grew up listening to or whatever. And I did find him a great, I found him a song I think was really great for him, you know, and he recorded the hell out of it. Big Man.
We've been talking about, you know, your songwriting, but you also produce. They're in San Francisco. You're in San Francisco right now, and I think that's your adopted home, the Rubinews, from there. And you co-wrote the material with Tommy Dunbar on a recent Rubinews album, 2019 album From Home. You also produced it.
Yes.
What was it like getting to work with those guys?
The greatest. You know, I mean, the Rubinews played in my high school. You know, I saw them when I was like 16. I used to follow them around a little bit. I was in bands that opened for them. I probably saw them like 25 times, you know. And I remember thinking, like, if bands are this good, I can't even imagine what it's going to be like in the future. You know, because they would... the breadth of what they could do, you know, with the four-part singing.
Yeah.
They were sort of like the Beach Boys meets the Jackson 5. Not only that, even though they were, you know, probably not that much older than me, they seemed really grown up. They'd been to England, you know, they'd been on television, they'd made records. You know, I was always pretty enamored with those guys, and Tommy was a big influence on me. And then later, Tommy and I got together to write, and that just sort of led to us writing an album for the Rubinews. You know, I mean, everything that we talked about, we'd talk a lot about what made the great Rubinews records great, you know. And, you know, it just got to the point where I felt like everything that you need to know to make a great Rubinews record are embedded in those first two albums, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was always pestering Tommy about how they did it, and he said, well, you know, they're a bunch of ninth grade dropouts in Berkeley, you know, and they would practice every day, and they really worked on that stuff. And so you know, eventually thanks to Yep Rock Records really giving us the budget to do it right, we got back into Hyde Street Studios, you know. I mean, I think John Rubin, the singer, he stood in the same spot that he stood when they cut their first single, Gorilla, which was a cover of the Franco Family B-side or something, you know. And, you know, we made it just like they did in the old days. And, you know, we made an album called From Home, and I'm really proud of it. And honestly, I think... of all the records I've worked on, it's probably the one that I've listened to the most.
Oh, cool. Well, the title track, your 2017 album, is called Bobby Fuller Died for Your Sins. Did you ever read the 2015 book, The Life and Strange Death of Bobby Fuller, that Miriam Lena and Fuller's brother Randy collaborated on?
Yes, I've read everything you can find about Bobby Fuller. It's a mystery that just wants to stay a mystery, I guess.
And I found that as a it's like the first half of the book was pretty informative, and then it just kind of fell apart to me. I felt like it really could have been edited much, much better. It got really confusing towards the end, what they were hinting at, like, and, you know, what went down.
Well, I find Buddy, I find Bobby Fuller fascinating for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that he was a man out of time. And and I have always felt a little bit like a man out of time, not, you know, not to a Bobby Fuller levels, but he was a, I think he was a protege of Buddy Holly's.
Right.
The Bobby Fuller Four took off where Buddy left off, and were the biggest thing in El Paso, Texas, you know, for the teen dances and everything. And Bobby Fuller was also very interested in recording and producing. In fact, I think he went to Clovis, New Mexico, and was given a tour of the studio there where Buddy Holly cut those early records. And, you know, he and his brother got a little tour of the studio, and as soon as they got in the car, he said, okay, we're going to need 3 Neumann microphones. We're going to need a few bags of cement and some corrugated tin. I'll get back to that in a minute. And what they did was they built a studio in their house. And for the reverb, they created a reverb tank in the backyard by building a shack, you know, with corrugated tin, and then pumping the sound into it through a speaker, which was the way that we got reverb back in the day, whether it was Gold Star or whether it was Capitol or whether, you know. And so he created a reverb chamber in their backyard, and you know, he crafted those records together. And then they, you know, they could only go so far, so they relocated to Los Angeles, just as, you know, things are changing. You know, you got the Birds, you got the Beach Boys, you got the Beatles, everybody's wearing bangs. You know, that's just the Bees, Manfred. and they were these greasers from Texas, you know, and they were pretty out of step with the times, you know. So, but they made this undeniably classic record called I Fought the Law and the Law Won. And I think it sounds, I think that record sounds modern today.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Timeless, as all great rock and roll is. You mentioned him being this guy out of time, which I wholeheartedly agree with that. And as I've read up stuff, there was a, on the Sunset Strip somewhere, there was a Red Velvet Club. And, you know, those guys would play there, hang out there. The Knickerbockers, you know, were like a house band, or had a residency there. Elvis comes to town, he would hang out there. It was like this sort of enclave where, in the midst of all the hippiedom that's developing around them, where the last rock and rollers are like, you know, kind of like their, what do you call it? Their oasis.
And well, they needed what we call today a safe place.
Yes.
They needed a safe place to talk shit about the Beatles. You know, what are we going to do about these guys? I know Elvis Presley had, you know, obviously his feelings about the Beatles. He was conflicted.
Oh, yeah. You know that story about him? They go to meet him, and they go into the house, and he's sitting there on the couch playing bass to the to Mohair Sam. You know, Charlie's got Charlie Rich on the stereo, and he's playing to Mohair Sam. You know that story?
Well, I know that it was an awkward meeting, and I remember that being told he was playing bass. I'm assuming they were in the jungle room.
But yeah, it was Mohair Sam, and what I think is so cool about that is that I can't remember if this was from Ringo or from John Lennon's perspective, but the comment was made, oh, that was one of our favorite records at the time. Now, whether it was or not, at least they seem to be familiar with it, you know, and I've always thought what a cool song Mohair Sam is.
Well, everything Charlie Rich touched was so cool. And in the later years, you know, Charlie Rich played the piano on the Jerry Lee records if there were any minor chords or anything tricky.
Hey, you mentioned your better half a moment ago, Ms. Stephanie Finch. When did you guys meet? How long have you been married?
We've been married over 20 years now. And we met here in... I think we met in Los Angeles. We might have met at a Peter Case gig. She was... going out with my friend at the time, and I always joke around that one night we were all sitting around with the acoustic guitars playing and singing, and she started singing, and I got this funny feeling. I said, "What's that thing you're doing with your voice?" And she said, "Singing." I said, "No, that weird thing." She said, "A harmony." I go, "Yeah." And so, yeah, we would sing together a lot in the early days. And, she's been in the band all these years. And, it's been an adventure.
So today is August the 19th. When is your next gig?
We're playing Sunday. We're playing this Sunday in Pengrove, California, which is up about an hour north of San Francisco. We're playing at the Twin Oaks Roadhouse. It's an authentic roadhouse. We're playing in the back patio. It's an authentic place. It's been open over 100 years. There's a gravel parking lot. And we've been playing there every Sunday in August. And we did a week residency last year, decided to do it again. And it's just been great. So get on up there. We got live music, barbecue, beer, and a gravel parking lot, which is just seems kind of it's perfect.
All right, it seems more real that way.
Yeah, well, it gets us out of the cool gray city of love here, the concrete jungle, and we love going up there and playing, and we do two sets, and we stretch out, and we're playing a lot of deep cuts and covers, and it's just been great for the band, the Mission Express, with James DePrado on guitar and Kevin T. White on bass, of course, and Vicente Rodriguez from San Antonio playing drums. And yeah, it's just been great for us, especially after having suffered through the pandemic and getting let out of pandemic purgatory. Now it's an outside show, and the nights are just beautiful up there in August. So there you go.
So deep cuts, and that leads me to ask you about 2020's album, The Land That Time Forgot. So are you playing a lot of stuff off that? Because I imagine you didn't have a chance to really tour to support that one.
Yeah, we're playing a lot of stuff off that record, and a lot of it works pretty good live, You never know,
well, Andrew. Hey, the opening track, Best Shirt On, that's a winner. I like that.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Absolutely, and I see a lot of people at the shows, they've got their best shirt on and they're looking to get noticed, and I got the song for them.
Right. Well, so about shirts and suits, I was thinking, man, you would look good in like a nudie suit. Got anything like that? Some rhinestone thing sitting in the closet anywhere?
I haven't gone through a nudie suit phase, but I've got a little bit of everything, I'm wearing an Italian suit at the moment. That's
such a sharp dress, man. I must
say. I play the same guitar, and I'm not really, somebody that mows through fuzz pedals or anything. So I got to do something to make myself feel good.
Yeah. Well, when I hear that phrase that, best shirt on, to me, it conjures up being a kid, and maybe we were going to see relatives, or the relatives are coming, or some school or church function, and it's sort of like, boy, go get your best shirt on. What does that phrase mean to you?
Well, that's really what it is. It's about honoring whatever you're doing and hoping to get noticed, really. I tell people, you got to put your best shirt on these days. You may be wandering the aisle. I tell the ladies, I said, you might be pushing a cart down the aisles of Whole Foods, and you might run into somebody like Elon Musk. You could wake up with little Elon twins, So I see people at the store, and they're wearing sweats,
No, I don't know.
I don't understand that, I just encourage people to wear their best shirt,
Well, another favorite track of mine off The Land That Time Forgot is Marathon. Are you much of a dancer?
I'm not much of a dancer, but there is a video where Stephanie and I are dueling it out. And, that song really came together.
Yes, it did.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's unusual, you know. I mean, I didn't really see it coming. I think it's the song is obviously an homage to the marathon dances during the Depression era, where people would what I consider really the earliest reality shows. You know, people would dance until they dropped, and other people would pay money to watch that.
Well, I have to say that most musicians I know really aren't big on dancing, although many of these people will bitch when the audience isn't.
Well, that's funny. Yeah. Right.
How about you? Do you bitch at those people if they're not dancing?
I do notice there's a lot less dancing, you know. I mean, in the 80s, you would see a lot more dancing at shows. I like to see it, you know. I don't bitch about it. I mean, I might complain about it a little in private, but.
What inspired you to write the tune?
Well, I co-wrote it with my friend Kurt, and uh-huh. I don't really recall how the title started getting kicked around, you know, but it just kept getting fleshed out, and I think we put it down and we picked it up later. It was really when we started working on the record, we had that kind of kraut rock, Donna Summer, you know, bass line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, putting the acoustics over the top, it just started to get that chocolate and peanut butter thing happening, you know, and
those two great tastes is what you mean.
Yeah. And that go great together. And it was kind of full of surprise, and it ended up, you know, we, instead of the vocal being a traditional harmony, we started doing a call and response, as they call it. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And that, then it really, then
songwriting
it really,
trick there. Yeah, call and response.
Sorry. I got confused. And then the song really came alive, you know, and when the record was done, it just kind of floated to the top. You know, that happened.
So who's Kurt? You said you wrote it with Kurt. Who's
Kurt? Kurt Lipschutz goes by the name of pen name of Clipschutz. He's a longtime friend of mine. We've written countless songs together over the years. He's published several books of poetry that I encourage people to check out. And, we used to write songs. We had a long break in the middle because we had a fight over money. There was just simply too much of it.
Oh, I hate when that happens, right? What an albatross.
Yeah. And then we came together to write a record called Temple Beautiful. You know, actually that was probably inspired by my experience with Alejandro Escovedo when Alejandro, you know, sat me down and said, look, we're going to write a record, you know, together, start to finish, let's do it. And so when we wrote Real Animal together, mm-hmm. over the course of like a year, that was really one of the happiest years of my life, you know.
Oh.
It was a wonderful time. And so Kurt and I got together and we were kind of writing, nothing particularly great, but She Done Me Wrong songs that weren't particularly inspired. And then we tapped into something. I don't know if it was Willie Mays' Up at Bat or whatever. And that's when I said, you know, we could scrap everything we'd done. And if we made this like a San Francisco record, it could really be fun. And so we wrote that record, Temple Beautiful. We got Roy Loney to come down and sing on the title track. And
right.
Little Steven picked it for the coolest song in the world. And that ended up being a really great time for us, creative time. And we've continued to write since then.
Chuck, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Manfred, I want to thank you for the attention and thanks for digging deep. It goes a long way. I really do appreciate it.
Well, you're certainly welcome. Now, with our dance shoes on, it's time to get the marathon started. It's Chuck Prophet. and Little Steven's Underground Garage. Here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with some of his song Marathon. That track is off his 2020 album The Land That Time Forgot. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Chuck for joining me today, and also thanks to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Ozo Motley is a Los Angeles-based band that's been active for some 27 years now, and they blend rock, funk, Latin, reggae, and even hip-hop to come up with their own unique musical sound. Their saxophone player, Uli Bea, he'll be my guest next time around, and we'll check in and catch up with the band on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Give me a mic check for Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, hello, check one Tampa, check two Tampa. I need some more on one.
Okay.
Casino, check, check. Hard Rock, Tampa, check, check. Seminole. Hard Rock.
Check it out for yourself at SeminoleHardRock.com. All right, guys, I'm rolling. Let's kick it.